President Trump justified his recognition of Jerusalem as the Israeli capital with these words: "I've judged this course of action to be in the best interests of the United States of America and the pursuit of peace between Israel and the Palestinians. This is a long overdue step to advance the peace process and to work toward a lasting agreement," end quote. Is it? Reactions have been sharply divided. The announcement upended decades of U.S. policy and shows increasing signs of fueling unrest throughout the Arab world. Ibrahim Aoudeh is a professor in the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, who vehemently disagrees with the president's decision. He spoke with us earlier this morning, and we asked him why the people of Hawaii should care.
The world is getting smaller and smaller because of, all this social media and all of that. But most importantly is because the U.S. is involved in that part of the world for its pursuing its global strategies and its imperatives of what I call imperatives of state. That is to say, U.S. interest in oil and gas and the geostrategic positions and positioning of U.S. military bases all over the Middle East, as you know. Mm-hmm. So people should know about this because these are tax dollars at play, and you wouldn't want the U.S. government, the federal government, to do something rash that really would be against the interests of the United States, the people of the United States, but perhaps in the interest of transnational corporations, oil and gas, and the rest of it.
Was the president's announcement something rash?
I think it's a recipe for disaster. That's how I look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taking the U.S. into the unknown, it seems to me. That's my assessment of the situation. And the reason for this is because he spelled the death of the peace process, which wasn't really in the interest of the Palestinian people, because the Palestinian people have compromised on it by saying that they would have a state of their own on 22% of geographic Palestine, traditional Palestine,
yeah,
and the rest, 78%, would be for the Israelis. But this peace process is dead now. So what's happening now is huge demonstrations across the Arab world and all of the capitals, etc., in Jerusalem and the West Bank. Just yesterday, 100 people were wounded by Israeli bullets, because they were protesting against this position of the United States through the Trump announcement. The other thing that is important in this regard is that Trump justified his announcement by saying this is a great deal for the Israelis and the Palestinians. And here we are talking about U.S. recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of the State of Israel that was created in Palestine through ethnic cleansing in 1948. And this is highly, very well documented. So people should know about this kind of stuff. But he never consulted the Palestinians. In fact, he indirectly asked the heir to the throne, the Saudi throne, to inform Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian National Authority, that if you don't agree with this deal, the new deal, then you will regret it. So it was like a threat to the Palestinians through threatening Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the president of the Palestinian National Authority. So this really is a problem because he shows, displays arrogance and disrespect for the Palestinian people. And if you want to do something that is good for both the Palestinians and the Israelis, you have to consult the Palestinians as well and see whether it is true that it is in their own benefit or not, you see. So that is the problem as regards the announcement.
Is this a rejection of the so-called two-state solution?
The peace process, which is the two-state solution, like the Palestinians will take 22% of geographic Palestine and 78% for the Israelis, is the two-state solution.
Yeah, that's...
Two-state solution is now dead. That's it. And the Palestinians right now, as we speak, they are talking about that he, by killing the two-state solution, he's killing the Oslo process. So why should we be in Oslo? So a lot of Palestinian groups are now calling, and the Palestinian people as a whole are calling for the withdrawal from Oslo because it's dead already. So why should you be in something that is dead, right? And so that is the situation now. There are going to be a lot of problems for the United States in the Middle East, from now on. Not that there were no problems for the U.S. in the Middle East, because it has been defeated, or it was defeated in Iraq. It can't get out of Afghanistan. It has all kinds of problems with all kinds of peoples in the Arab world and in the Muslim world, and this is not good for the United States.
Doctor, given what you've just said, why do it? What was the rationale?
Well, I think Trump is very rash, inconsistent, illogical. He is completely in the small pocket of the Zionists in the United States through AIPAC, America, Israel Public Affairs Committee, and he is in the pocket of Netanyahu. Netanyahu tells him what to say. He's the Prime Minister of Israel, and he does it. Jared Kushner, who is a Zionist through and through, is his son-in-law, right?
Yeah.
And he's a Zionist. And so he's the one actually heading this new thing called the deal of the century in terms of solving the Palestinian question and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So if it is a deal of the century, you have to talk to the Palestinians, not talk with them. And the other thing is that, well, who is he talking with? He's talking with the heir to the Saudi throne, Mohammed bin Salman, who threatened Mahmoud Abbas, as I mentioned before, about all of this, that either you accept this or you're going to regret it. That is a complete threat. And Mohammed bin Salman is having all kinds of problems. All of his policies have failed in the Middle East, from Syria, from Iraq, from the Yemen, and internal problems, a lot of disturbances in the Saudis, in Saudi Arabia, even within the royal family, right? Because he, arrested scores of princes and scores of business people and all of that.
Doctor, do you see this, the anger that you've described, spreading in weeks to come?
Yes, yeah. And it's spreading, and it's going to take a different turn that even the U.S. Doesn't expect. And this is most dangerous. And already the Middle East is a place where you have all kinds of instability and wars, etc. So you're adding another war to the wars in the Middle East. And are we going to see, like, U.S. troops in the Middle East again in huge numbers, like in the tens of thousands? That is the rhetorical question. But that is something that American people should understand and should reassess, like demand to reassess the relationship between the State of Israel in Palestine and the United States.
Ibrahim Oude is a professor in the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You can find a link to some of his work on Middle East politics and social movements in today's edition of the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org.
David Becker has been called a poet on the guitar. He has shared the stage with many of the most celebrated jazz acts and now brings his orchestra of guitars to HPR's Atherton Studio on December 16th. Purchase your seat at hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, grad students look at the potential impact of the Republican tax plan. But first, your quiz. Hawaii has appeared in dozens of films and TV shows, and our islands continue to be an exotic place to shoot. Off the top of your head, there's a good chance you can name at least 10 movies with a Hawaii credit, but in today's quiz, we're focusing on reality TV programs. 11 years ago, MTV produced a couple of shows on Maui, both modeled after the network's successful reality shows Laguna Beach and The Hills. One of the shows was located in Ka'anapali. Despite its success in ratings, it faced heavy criticism and a strong negative response from local residents. The outcry ultimately brought about the show's cancellation. Today, we'd like you to name that show. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, and Hawaii Pacific University.
The proposed Republican tax plan working its way through Congress has a 29% approval rating nationwide. That's according to polls from Gallup and Quinnipiac University. One group the plan is especially unpopular with is graduate students. Many grad students in the U.S. are given free tuition by the university in exchange for their work as teaching assistants. But under the House version of the GOP tax plan, those tuition waivers would be counted as taxable income. This has outraged graduate students across the country, many of whom say the cost of a doctoral degree will become unaffordable. To hear how graduate students at Hawaii's largest university are reacting, conversation producer Ryan Finnerty called Taylor Lewis, president of the UH Manoa Graduate Student Organization.
Taylor, can you start by just telling me what's the general mood on the campus regarding this tax bill in the graduate student community?
It's honestly kind of a state of going between anger and fear. It's all that all graduate students are talking about right now, thinking about what can we do to prevent this bill from passing or prevent those line items about graduate student tuition and exemptions, as well as student loan interest deductions, from going into the final bill or having the bill not even pass. And if the bill passes, then what are our options? Is it dropping out of University of Hawaii? Is it leaving the country to go to another university outside of the U.S.? It's just a lot of, like, uncertainty and fear and just really what do we do given all of these things coming at us at once.
And what are the major concerns about this bill? From your perspective.
The major concerns is that it would basically price people out of grad school, because right now having a graduate assistantship is a huge help because, yes, you don't have to worry about paying tuition. You also get a salary, so you don't have to worry about finding a full-time job outside of school and then taking classes on top of that and worrying to have to pay for tuition as well within all of these things. So it's a nice way of merging student life and kind of real life. So having that attack, having to pay for tuition, which is not income, right? It's something that you pay. It's not something that you can take home and pay your bills with. So then basically being taxed on money that you do not have when you're already struggling to try to fulfill the taxes of the income that you do receive means that you're going kind of into a deficit.
So the major issue is that right now many graduate students get their tuition waived by the university, so they don't have to pay tuition, and that's not considered taxable income. But you also receive a stipend that is already taxed. Is that correct?
Yes.
So the big change in this bill would be that your tuition waiver, which, as you just said, is never money that you actually see, it's just a cost that the university waives, now could be considered taxable income.
Yeah. So right now, for example, there are 1,247 graduate assistants at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And so that's, a little less than half, maybe a third of the graduate student population. So it's not maybe a majority of the population, but it is a significant part. And then also looking at students who are incoming and looking, so the prospect of going to graduate school, since no longer a thing of, okay, so even though I'm taking on an additional kind of schooling endeavor, it's not necessarily going to be taking on a bunch of loans because there's this opportunity. So even thinking about grad school, if that added tax liability is there, then what's the point actually if it's not a benefit financially?
So do you know approximately what the financial impact would be on a graduate student who now sees this tuition waiver as taxable income?
Yeah, so right now we're looking at is a $1,000 to $3,000 added tax liability, which could be up to a 160% increase tax or rate that we're taxed at.
So that's pretty significant for someone who's not working full time and on a student budget.
Absolutely.
What are some of your fellow graduate students saying? What are people thinking about doing other than trying to influence the course of this bill to a more favorable outcome for you? What are people thinking about doing if this does pass?
Yeah, like I said, it's something that comes up every day. So there are students who are looking at even leaving as soon as next semester, so it doesn't count on their 2018 taxes. There are students who are looking at finishing their degrees and then pursuing another degree at a university outside of the country. There are students who are looking at limiting their time on campus or reducing their course load. So instead of going full time or spending more time on campus, then they're basically looking at trying to leave as quickly as possible. But basically the main thing is trying to get off of campus because in some way or form, because that would be a cheaper option, kind of.
David Lassner, president of the University of Hawaii system, said that he's had FaceTime with members of the Hawaii congressional delegation since this issue came up. Has the university worked with your organization at all to try and assuage fears or find a potential solution?
Yeah, so the GSO has been talking with the Office of Graduate Education as well as President and Interim Chancellor Lassner. So that statement came out of coordination between us and those two offices, basically just because we had noticed that a lot of universities around the country are putting out statements about the work that they're doing or trying to take a stance on the issue and persuade their legislatures to take some action against the bill. And so the GSO is basically looking for something similar just to help demonstrate to students that the university is fighting for them. So it was nice to see that statement. It is frustrating because there's only so much that we can do within Hawaii since it is a blue state. But that is also why the GSO, especially as court, are trying to encourage students to reach out to their friends and family in other states that may be red or purple to have our voices heard there. where we may be able to help, you know, flip a senator or a representative.
Taylor, there was a doctoral candidate at Georgetown University in Washington quoted by the AP as saying that this, if this provision goes through, it has the potential to upend the American PhD system. In your experience here at the University of Hawaii, is that a possibility? Are we looking at a real sea change in how graduate degrees are achieved in this country?
Absolutely. Like I said, a lot of students are looking at cutting their, not even pursuing their degrees or leaving campus. And I know there are a lot of students who, I think the main thing to remember in all of this is that graduate students are not kind of a privileged group. Like, many of us are coming from households that can't support our education. And so we have to do that on our own. And that's not with kind of a safety net or some savings or inheritance or something like that. That's coming, usually coming from having $30,000+ in debt from undergrad and having to pay those back on top of pursuing graduate school. So what a tuition exemption does with the graduate assistantship is provides an opportunity to support yourself through getting a higher degree. And so, like I said, that opportunity alone, knowing that that is there, is a big reason why people think graduate school is a reality rather than something that is only for people of a certain tax bracket. So but basically saying, no, this education is not something that everybody should be able to pursue. It's only for people who can afford it, which is kind of already the case, right? But even making it more so clear that this is education is for a privileged few communicates to prospective graduate students, to current graduate students, that effectively our place is not to be here. Our place is, you know, not in academia.
Taylor Lewis is president of the University of Hawaii at Manoa Graduate Student Organization. Taylor, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
The federal government imposes strict requirements for disability access in public housing units, requirements it says Hawaii has failed to meet. A Department of Housing and Urban Development investigation into the Hawaii Housing Authority has revealed hundreds of violations, and Civil Beat reporter Anita Hofschneider has more in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Anita.
Aloha, thanks for having me.
Sure. This has been a struggle for the state going back a ways, hasn't it?
Yes, the Housing Authority has been has actually been the recipient of a couple of lawsuits in past years related to this topic of upgrading units. And last year, actually even settled a civil rights complaint with a family that wanted to be moved into an accessible unit.
What are the requirements? You know, things like ramps instead of staircases, things of that nature.
Exactly. There's a certain percentage of units in the Housing Authority that need to be accessible for disabled people, as well as a certain number of common spaces like ramps, as you say, or public areas. And that's what was the subject of this investigation. The Disability Rights Center filed a complaint last year saying that the Public Housing Authority didn't have enough units for disabled people to meet those requirements.
But that would take a lot of units, and it sounds as if, based on these complaints, that there's a lot of upgrading to be done. So there's a big cost problem in their future, isn't it?
Exactly. The preliminary results came out in October, and the investigation found more than 470 ways in which the units and common spaces that were supposed to be accessible actually weren't. And in some cases, there were people living in accessible units who didn't need them.
Does the local Hawaii Public Housing Authority have the resources to address these complaints?
Well, the local housing authority is actually appealing the results. They say that their contractors were shocked by the findings and they want to verify them because they've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars upgrading these units. In terms of resources, they have about $800 million backlog for repairs and maintenance of these units, and I'm sure that they will be coming to the legislature this year asking for more funding for general repairs as well as these repairs if the HUD's findings bear out.
$800 million?
Yes.
That's not likely to be forthcoming from the legislature, I wouldn't think. Or even anything even close
I agree.
To that, right?
Yeah, that's a backlog, I believe, that is over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so every year they come to the legislature hoping to kind of chip away at that. And in the past, I think when I've reported, it's been even higher than that, $825 million. But as you know, every year the units get older and many of them were built decades and decades ago. So it's a constant struggle for upkeep and repairs.
Given the age of the units, it would be unlikely that that number is going to diminish in the next few years.
I think it just depends on how much money they get from the legislature, as well as how quickly they're able to repair those units. It's one of those things that's an ongoing struggle.
Certainly sounds like it. Thanks very much, Anita.
Thank you for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Anita Hofschneider. Fridays give us an opportunity to check in with our news department as to the stories that our news folks are working on. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director, and he's with us in our studio. Bill, we're following up on some stories we talked about on the show this week. We talked a little bit about beach erosion and its relation to climate change with regard to Waikiki. But
no, exactly. Dolan Eversole, he was so good on that. That not only setting that out in terms of some of the challenges, some of the issues, but also thinking about the impact of that. And yes, if you live in Waikiki, and yes, if you're on Oahu, but even for neighbor islands,
yeah.
Because of the impact for the state revenue coming in on that. So similarly, Chip Fletcher is a familiar name to a lot of folks, School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology at UH. Chip's done a lot of work on different aspects of climate change, sea level rise. And again, that touches on Waikiki, it touches on Kaka'ako, but again, it's some of these broader statewide issues as well. Noe Tanigawa sat down with Chip, got his perspective on a number of these issues and some of the science around this, and putting some of that into context for, again, thinking as we think ahead in the new year, look at some of these issues.
It's going to affect a lot of people. And you also have a different kind of story that also goes statewide.
Yeah, this one, childhood obesity. A lot of folks, when you look around the country, Hawaii doesn't always pop up in the upper echelons of this, but it is, it's shifted in recent years. It's more of an issue here now than it used to be. State Department of Health apparently came out with some figures that one out of four kids going to kindergarten now are obese. That's
yikes.
Yeah, exactly. But again, as with so many things, it's a complicated issue because some of this has to do with accessibility to healthy food, which a lot of times, if folks aren't able to, run out to farmers markets, it's also healthy food is more expensive in some situations than non-healthy. So the idea is to take the, farm-to-table movement and put a little tweak on that and farm to school, getting healthy local food into schools. There are some nonprofits working with Department of Health on this. So Wayne Yoshioka is going to go out to an elementary school, have some lunch with some kindergartners and first graders and come back with some updates on that.
Yeah, that'll be really worth pursuing. And of course, this weekend is the beginning of the Pipeline Masters. It's a big day, big week ahead in the surfing world.
Big
right?
deal, yes. And again, the as you say, final event of the season, all of that. And to be honest, I can tell you more about politics in Australia than I can about professional surfing in Hawaii. But fortunately,
that's why we have reporters.
Exactly. Kuvehi Hiraishi is going to be taking care of that. She also tells us that there's a new wave, if you will, of surfers from Hawaii making a comeback on the professional trail and sort of looking ahead to next season with that as well. So that'll be a good check-in.
And we've got to at least mention a virtuoso guitar player coming to Hawaii.
I tell you, so the UH Hilo Jazz Orchestra has this annual program they've been doing for a while, celebrating the music of Frank Zappa. And this year, Dweezil, Frank's son, coming up playing live in Hilo. He talked with Dave Lawrence, and that's going to be on this afternoon on All Things Considered. And Dweezil, not only a great guitarist, but he's kind of a good storyteller as well.
Yeah, well, as was his father. That'll be.
Oh boy, you're not kidding.
That'll be great to hear about. Thanks a lot, Bill.
You bet.
Monday on this program, we interviewed Representative Tulsi Gabbard about a bill she co-sponsored that would ban the use of taxpayer funds in settlement payouts for congressional misconduct. Katie O'Brien Bailey from Portsmouth, Maryland, said this on Facebook. Past payments should also be clawed back. Taxpayers aren't paying hard-earned dollars to cover for representatives' punishments. These people committed theft besides the original sins. Ann Wong said on Twitter, does Tulsi Gabbard care about harassed, assaulted women or only taxpayers covering settlements? Why'd she skip the Women's March and go to Syria? Why did she visit Trump Tower instead of calling him out on harassment? And why didn't she change the bill so it protects all sexual harassment complainants against enforced secrecy in settlements and not just those who are in Congress? It's Congress. They have the power to protect everyone, not just staffers. Angel Rodart Jr. tweeted, I'm sure there's a treasure trove of sex allegations against many a politician in there. Busting that open would be a great way to clean our government of the predatory and corrupt. We thank you for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our Talkback line at 792-8217.
SpongeBob SquarePants famously lives in a pineapple under the sea, but now he's on Broadway. Tina Landau directs the show.
The thing that I received most working on the show was his joy. It was infectious.
SpongeBob SquarePants, the musical, plus the latest on Congress and the tax bill. Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News. Said it's gonna be
the best day. Just tomorrow morning from 5 to 9.
As 2017 comes to a close, Hawaii has the 35th highest suicide rate among American states, according to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Now, that low ranking may seem like a cause to be optimistic, but it still translates into one death by suicide in Hawaii every 2 days. Young people are the primary focus of suicide here, according to State Representative John Mizuno. He chairs the Hawaii State House Committee on Health and Human Services and is part of the push in the state legislature to bring down the suicide rate. He spoke with our producer, Ryan Finnerty, earlier this morning.
Representative John Mizuno, thanks for joining us this morning. Can you tell me how big of a problem is suicide in the state of Hawaii?
It's extremely high. Unfortunately, you know, people look at Hawaii as one of the top tourist destinations in the world, and it's a paradise. Nonetheless, we have a suicide every 2 days, one occurs, so it is very prevalent in our state.
What are some of the probable causes for having such a high suicide rate?
A number of things. Bullying, cyberbullying, sometimes people are trying to communicate their pain, mental illness, drug addiction, family history of violence. A number of things can trigger a person to commit suicide or attempt suicide, and what we're trying to do is equip people to have better awareness, education, and the ability to prevent the suicide from occurring.
And Representative Mizuno, are there any specific populations or demographic groups here in Hawaii that are more have higher rates of suicide?
Very good question. Excellent question. You would think it would usually just be the lower income or the homeless. No, unfortunately, it's generally throughout the broad spectrum. Even many of the rich kids, people in the higher income brackets, throughout the middle class and lower classes, unfortunately, commit suicide. And so there's no specific group you can target this to, and it's unfortunate, but it has really hurt our state.
How about age? Is there a certain range of ages in which we see this more prevalent than others?
Very good question. Also, yes, unfortunately, we see a lot of suicides occurring in the youth ages, some of the younger youth in our state. Again, it can be attributed to bullying, cyberbullying, or not being understood. Nonetheless, this is a very big concern. And so there's actually, because the rate of youth suicide is quite high, there's actually a branch in the Department of Health that specifically works on preventing youth suicide and also providing awareness. And to make it even longer, to provide intervention services after this has occurred, because many times a young person commits suicide and the family's just devastated. They don't know what to do. And God forbid, we'd hate to lose another one in that family. And so they provide counseling services too. Because this happens and it's so prevalent, intervention services are also important so that the family can grieve, but understand, heal, and move forward without another, God forbid, another fatality happening at the hands of suicide.
So what types of policy tools are you as a legislator looking at exploring to address this problem?
Thank you. Again, an excellent question. We've got two bills. Now, we're having an informational briefing today at 1 o'clock at the state capitol, both the Senate Consumer Protection Health Committee and on the House side, our Health and Human Services Committee, because this is such a prevalent issue. The two bills that we have targeted at better addressing suicide and providing more awareness, education, and intervention services would be, first, we had a bill just specifically on a task force. The reason why it's important to put the task force in the bill is when you have great task force members, part of the team would be from the Department of Health, that Youth Suicide Division branch. But we have a great cadre of people that have expertise in this area in the community. You put a good team together. The reason you want to codify it in law is because when they share their recommendations to, for example, the Department of Education on how to better address and reduce suicide in schools, many times, unless it's codified in law, the Department of Education may say, well, you know, that's a nice recommendation, but why should we listen to you? I mean, what authority do you have? And so this task force is actually created. It was created and established from a concurrent resolution, which is still good, and it can always urge and recommend policies. But when you put a task force in law, it has a lot more clout. And the Department of Education, as well as many of the other departments and private schools, are more willing to listen, because once the task force, which is in statute, state statute, makes a strong recommendation, if the Department of Education or the private schools or other entities or organizations do not listen and a suicide occurs later, that's a lawsuit. There's liability. And that's the impact of having a task force placed in a bill, passed, and put into statute. That's a very important and effective means of really better addressing suicide in our state. The second bill I have, non-controversial, is to provide September of every year as Suicide Awareness, Education, and Prevention Month. It's very important that we get the issue out. Unfortunately, in Hawaii, where we love the spirit of Ohana and Aloha, and we unfortunately don't talk about private issues, and suicide happens to be a private issue to many of our families. This changes the game. It says every September we are going to talk about this. We're going to hold joint meetings throughout the state, have suicide walks, have intervention programs where we have grieving families explain about how difficult it was and how they missed the signs, so that this doesn't happen a second time to other families that may not know the signs of someone thinking or contemplating suicide.
So, Representative Mizuno, I think a lot of Americans, when they hear the word suicide, one group that comes to mind are military veterans. There's been a lot of public discussion of how big of a problem that is within that group of people. and bringing it out into the daylight has been really key in addressing that problem. And it's still a big problem, but in moving in a positive direction. Is there anything that the state of Hawaii can learn from those efforts that have been made?
Absolutely, especially for our men and women in uniform who have placed their lives on the line in harm's way for the defense of our freedoms. We need to support our veterans. Many times our veterans will come back after war, and they're not the same because of post-traumatic stress disorder, and I think everyone understands that. We've learned a lot from the military. Military would be part of the task force. They would work with us because they know the signs. And again, Hawaii, we are extremely dependent on the military. They protect the Pacific Ocean. That's half the world. And so it's important and incumbent on us to not only work alongside with the VA and the military, but also to listen to some of their recommendations, because it definitely provides guidance for us in our suicide prevention policies. So yes, the Suicide Prevention Task Force, should we get this into law, would definitely have a VA person, a representative on that team, and that team would again provide policies and recommendations so we can best address suicide and hopefully reduce it by 25% by year 2025. The national recommendations reduce suicide by 20%. Of course, if we had our way and if we had a magic wand, we'd say 100%. But thinking realistically, I'm glad that Hawaii's taking the initiative, and we want to reduce it by at least one quarter by year 2025. If more, that'll be great. The national average, our goal is only 20% by year 2025. But the veterans play a very key role for this, and that's why we're glad we're going to have VA representation on that task force. Hopefully we can pass it in law in 2018.
All right, Representative John Mizuno, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
John Mizuno represents Kalihi and Kamehameha Heights in the Hawaii House of Representatives and chairs the House Committee on Health and Human Services. The Prevent Suicide Hawaii Task Force will be giving a briefing at the state capitol today at 1 p.m. in room 329.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-working.
Earlier in the show, we asked you to name the MTV program that was filmed in Ka'anapali in 2006. The show was broadcast in early 2007, and during its run, it faced strong criticism for its editing, which made many believe the reality show was in fact scripted. It also received backlash from local residents because of its perceived lack of racial and cultural diversity, along with its adult content. Many residents also felt that these factors brought with them misconceptions of Maui and of Hawaii in general. Nevertheless, the show was a success. Today we asked you to name it, and maybe you were one of the millions of viewers worldwide who watched Maui Fever. Or maybe you weren't, because nobody got that answer right today, but that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is Jason Taglianetti, host of Applause in a Small Room. This year in the Atherton Studio, we presented concerts and conversations with amazing musical artists from around the world and around our islands. Your gift ensures that we will continue to have a place where we can come together and celebrate the power of music. Whether you find that place on our air or at our live gatherings, please support HPR today. Donate through the HPR mobile app. Thanks, and happy holidays.
It's one of the struggles involved in running a small business in Hawaii, providing health care to employees, and a recently announced federal grant is designed to make that challenge a little easier. Last week, we spoke with Linda Chu Takeyama outgoing director of the State Department of Labor and Industrial Relations about that $427,000 supplemental payment.
First, I'll give you a little bit of background. You are correct. Hawaii is different from all of the other states. We think we are eons ahead of everybody else, mainly because of something we have called the Prepaid Health Care Act. Under this act, all employers are required to offer health insurance to their employees. So that automatically covers the great majority of folks who live and work in our state. Currently, the number is around 700,000 lives. Mm-hmm. So that's the great majority of people. What we have done once the Affordable Care Act was adopted, since we already had most of the kinds of coverages that the ACA required, we kind of set out to make sure that we protected everything that we already had.
Yeah.
One of the things that we wanted to ensure was that our small businesses in particular continue to have the benefits of the Prepaid Health Care Act. One of the things that we were particularly concerned about was that they continue to have access to what is called community rating, which is different from what ACA required, which was age rating. So if you were a small business in particular that had a lot of older employees, your rates would tend to go up just because of the age of your employee base.
Mm-hmm.
So we immediately filed for a waiver from some of the requirements of the ACA. We were the first state to file for the waiver, the first state to be granted a waiver. And as part of the waiver agreement, the federal government agreed to provide us some funding for some premium supplementation that would help small businesses pay for the premium on their health care insurance. So this was in lieu of certain kinds of tax benefits that were otherwise provided under Obamacare. So in maintaining their part of the deal, they recently awarded us $428,000 for the first year, 2017, of our waiver coverage. So we are preparing now to accept applications from small businesses. These are small businesses of 8 or less employees,
right,
all of whom must otherwise qualify for the Prepaid Health Care Act. They can file from a form on our website to get part of these premium supplementation coverages. So this is sort of a subsidy for what they're paying for their employees to get health care. In the past, when the state paid for the subsidy, which we used to have on our own,
mm-hmm,
it would average out about $6,600 per employer. And that varies depending on what kinds of health plans they have, how many employees they have. So it's just really a subsidy that would help small businesses. And like I said, it's 8 or less employees that would otherwise qualify for prepaid health.
And these are small businesses whose rates would have otherwise gone up or whose rates are going up?
It's quite possible, yes.
So the idea being, it sounds as if the federal government is taking away with one arm and giving with another. Is that an inaccurate perception?
Well, it's supposed to balance out. So yes, they didn't want to present a case in which because we got this waiver, we would no longer have access to the tax credit. So this is in lieu of the tax credit they would otherwise have if they were under Obamacare.
In the current climate in which Obamacare is somewhat under siege, what do you foresee for the Hawaii Prepaid Health Care Act? Are we still better off than other states and likely to continue that way?
It's hard to say. For those employees who are getting their health insurance coverage under their employer, we are far better off. One of the reasons for that is under our Prepaid Health Care Act, the employer is paying all but 1.5% of the employee's annual wage. Mm-hmm. So that means that the employees, for the most part, are paying a tiny fraction of what the health care premium would be, the employer is required to pick up the rest. So as long as we continue to get what's called the ERISA exemption, we got an exemption from the federal government 40 years ago
right. That
allows us to do this. So as long as we can keep that, we're in good shape. Where the battlegrounds really have been identified is on the other side for those community people who do not have employer-based insurance. Either they're individuals or they're on Medicaid or possibly Medicare. So if they're not on an employer-based insurance plan, that's where the big issues are, because the subsidies on those side are what the members of Congress are fighting over right now.
So those are the people in the gap group today.
I would think so, because they're the future of their subsidies is really uncertain.
Mm-hmm. Linda Chu Takayama is the outgoing director of the State Department of Labor and Industrial Relations. In fact, this is her last day. She takes office as the director of the Hawaii State Department of Taxation on Monday. And that's it for this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, we'll meet Sherry Campagna, primary candidate running for Representative Tulsi Gabbard's congressional seat. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at TheConversationHPR. If you missed part of the program or any other, you can find them all on the HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale. And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us on Monday.